sexual activities, and to modify their bodies as they please. But if you believe that God prescribed every single detail of your body, as Warren writes in The Purpose-Driven Life, you will probably be offended by sexual diversity and by body modifications such as piercings and plastic surgery. My students and I have interviewed political liberals and conservatives about sexual morality and about body modifications, and in both studies, we found that liberals were much more permissive and relied overwhelmingly on the ethic of autonomy. Conservatives, much more critical, used all three ethics in their discourse. For example, one conservative man justified his condemnation of a story about an unusual form of masturbation. "It's a sin because it distances ourselves from God. It's a pleasure that God did not design for us to enjoy because sexual pleasures through, you know, a married heterosexual couple were designed by God in order to reproduce." On issue after issue, liberals want to maximize autonomy by removing limits, barriers, and restrictions. The religious right, on the other hand, wants to structure personal, social, and political relationships in three dimensions, and so create a landscape of purity and pollution where restrictions maintain the separation of the sacred and the profane. For the religious right, hell on earth is a flat land of unlimited freedom where selves roam around with no higher purpose than expressing and developing themselves. As a liberal, I value tolerance and openness to new ideas. I have done my best in this chapter to be tolerant toward those whose politics I oppose and to find merit in religious ideas I do not hold. But although I have begun to see the richness that divinity adds to human experience, I do not entirely lament the flattening of life in the West over the last few hundred years. An unfortunate tendency of three-dimensional societies is that they often include one or more groups that get pushed down on the third dimension and then treated badly or worse. Look at the conditions of untouchables in India until recently, or at the plight of Jews in medieval Europe and impurity-obsessed Nazi Germany, or at the humiliation of African Americans in the segregated South. The American religious right now seems to be trying to push homosexuals down in a similar way. Liberalism and the ethic of autonomy are great protectors against such injustices. I believe it is dangerous for the ethic of divinity to supersede the ethic of autonomy in the governance of a diverse modern democracy. However, I also believe that life in a society that entirely ignored the ethic of divinity would be ugly and unsatisfying. Because the culture war is ideological, both sides use the myth of pure evil. To acknowledge that the other side might be right about anything is an act of treason. My research on the third dimension, however, has freed me from the myth and made it easy for me to think treasonous thoughts. Here's one. If the third dimension and perceptions of sacredness are an important part of human nature, then the scientific community should accept religiosity as a normal and healthy aspect of human nature, an aspect that is as deep, important, and interesting as sexuality or language, which we study intensely. Here's another treasonous thought. If religious people are right in believing that religion is the source of their greatest happiness, then maybe the rest of us who are looking for happiness and meaning can learn something from them, whether or not we believe in God. That's the topic of the final chapter. Chapter 10. Happiness comes from between. Who sees all beings in his own self, and his own self in all beings, loses all fear. When a sage sees this great unity, and his self has become all beings, what delusion and what sorrow can ever be near him? Upanishads. I was entirely happy. Perhaps we feel like that when we die and become a part of something entire, whether it is sun and air, or goodness and knowledge. At any rate, that is happiness, to be dissolved into something complete and great. Willa Cather. Proverbs, sayings, and words of wisdom dignify events, so we often use them to mark important transitions in life. For the graduating class of 1981 at Scarsdale High School in Scarsdale, New York, choosing a quotation was a rite of passage, an opportunity to reflect on one's emerging identity and express some aspect of it. As I look through the yearbook from that class, at the quotations underneath each photo, I see two main kinds. Many are tributes to love and friendship, appropriate for a time of parting from friends. You never really leave the friends you love. Part of them you take with you, leaving a part of you behind. Anonymous. The other kind expresses optimism, sometimes mixed with trepidation, about the road ahead. Indeed, it is difficult to think about graduating from high school without using the metaphor that life is a journey. For example, four students quoted the Cat Stevens song, On the Road to Find Out. Two quoted George Washington, I am embarked on a wide ocean, boundless in its prospect and in which, perhaps, no safe harbor is to be found. And one student quoted this line from Bruce Springsteen, Well, I got some beer and the highway's free, and I got you, and baby, you've got me. But nestled among these affirmations of life's limitless possibilities is one with a darker tone. Whosoever shall not fall by the sword or by famine shall fall by pestilence. So why bother shaving? Woody Allen. Above those words is a photograph of me. I was only partly kidding. During the previous year, I had written a paper examining the play Waiting for Godot, Samuel Beckett's existentialist meditation on the absurdity of life in a world with no God, and it got me thinking. I was already an atheist, and by my senior year, I had become obsessed with the question, what is the meaning of life? I wrote my personal statement for college admissions on the meaninglessness of life. I spent the winter of my senior year in a kind of philosophical depression, not a clinical depression, just a pervasive sense that everything was pointless. In the grand scheme of things, I thought it really didn't matter whether I got into college or whether the Earth was destroyed by an asteroid or by nuclear war. My despair was particularly strange because, for the first time since the age of 4, my life was perfect. I had a wonderful girlfriend, great friends, and loving parents. I was captain of the track team, and, perhaps most important for a 17-year-old boy, I got to drive around in my father's 1966 Thunderbird convertible. Yet I kept wondering why any of it mattered. Like the author of Ecclesiastes, I thought that all is vanity and a chasing after wind. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 14. I finally escaped when, after a week of thinking about suicide, in the abstract, not as a plan, I turned the problem inside out. There is no God and no externally given meaning to life, I thought. So from one perspective, it really wouldn't matter if I killed myself tomorrow. Very well, then everything beyond tomorrow is a gift with no strings and no expectations. There is no test to hand in at the end of life, so there is no way to fail. If this really is all there is, why not embrace it rather than throw it away? I don't know whether this realization lifted my mood or whether an improving mood helped me to reframe the problem with hope, but my existential depression lifted and I enjoyed the last months of high school. My interest in the meaning of life continued, however, so in college I majored in philosophy, where I found few answers. Modern philosophers specialize in analyzing the meaning of words, but aside from the existentialists, who caused the problem for me in the first place, they had little to say about the meaning of life. It was only after I entered graduate school in psychology that I realized why modern philosophy seemed sterile. It lacked a deep understanding of human nature. The ancient philosophers were often good psychologists, as I have shown in this book, but when modern philosophy began to devote itself to the study of logic and rationality, it gradually lost interest in psychology and lost touch with the passionate, contextualized nature of human life. It is impossible to analyze the meaning of life in the abstract or in general or for some mythical and perfectly rational being. Only by knowing the kinds of beings that we actually are, with the complex mental and emotional architecture that we happen to possess, can anyone even begin to ask about what would count as a meaningful life. Philosophy has, to its credit, become more psychological and more passionate in recent years. As I went on in psychology and in my own research on morality, I discovered that psychology and related sciences have revealed so much about human nature that an answer is now possible. In fact, we've known most of the answer for 100 years, and many of the remaining pieces have fallen into place over the last 10. This chapter is my version of psychology's answer to the ultimate question. What was the question? The question, what is the meaning of life, might be called the holy question, in analogy to the Holy Grail. Its pursuit is noble, and everyone should want to find an answer, yet few people expect that one can be found. That's why books and movies that purport to tell us the answer to the holy question often do so only in jest. In The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, a gigantic computer built to answer the holy question spits out its solution after 7.5 million years of computation. 42. In the closing scene of the movie Monty Python's The Meaning of Life, the answer to the holy question is handed to the actor Michael Palin, in drag, who reads it aloud. Try to be nice to people. Avoid eating fat. Read a good book every now and then. Get some walking in. And try to live in harmony with people of all creeds and nations. These answers are funny precisely because they take the form of good answers, yet their content is empty or mundane. These parodies invite us to laugh at ourselves and ask, what was I expecting? What kind of answer could have satisfied me? One thing philosophy did teach me is how to analyze questions, how to clarify exactly what is being asked before giving an answer. The holy question cries out for clarification. Whenever we ask, what is the meaning of X? What kind of answer could possibly satisfy us? The most common kind of meaning is definitional. What is the meaning of anonym means, define the word anonym for me so that I can understand it when I read it. I go to a dictionary, look it up, and find that it means a pseudonym consisting of the real name written backwards. Very well. What is the meaning of life? I go back to the dictionary and find that life has 21 meanings, including the quality that distinguishes a vital and functional being from a dead body or purely chemical matter, and the period from birth to death, dead end. This is not at all the right kind of answer. We are not asking about the word life. We're asking about life itself. A second kind of meaning is about symbolism or substitution. If you dream about exploring a basement and finding a trap door to a sub-basement, you might ask, what is the meaning of the sub-basement? The psychologist Carl Jung had such a dream and concluded that the meaning of the sub-basement, the thing it symbolized or stood for, was the collective unconscious, a deep set of ideas shared by all people. But this is another dead end. Life does not symbolize, stand for, or point to anything. It is life itself that we want to understand. A third way in which we ask about meaning is as a plea for help in making sense of something, usually with reference to people's intentions and beliefs. Suppose you walk into a movie half an hour late and have to leave half an hour before the end. Later that night, you are talking with a friend who saw the whole film and you ask, what did it mean when the guy with the curly hair winked at that kid? You are aware that the act had some significance for the plot of the movie, and you suspect that you need to know certain facts to understand that act. Perhaps a prior relationship between the two characters had been revealed in the opening scenes. To ask, what was the meaning of the wink, really means, what do I need to know to understand that wink? Now we're making progress. For life is much like a movie we walk into well after its opening scene, and we will have to step out long before most of the storylines reach their conclusions. We are acutely aware that we need to know a great deal if we are to understand the few confusing minutes that we do watch. Of course, we don't know exactly what it is that we don't know, so we can't frame the question well. We ask, what is the meaning of life? Not expecting a direct answer, such as 42, but rather hoping for some enlightenment, something to give us an aha experience in which suddenly things that we had not before understood or recognized as important begin to make sense, as they did for the square taken to the third dimension. Once the holy question has been reframed to mean, "Tell me something enlightening about life," the answer must involve the kinds of revelations that human beings find enlightening. There appear to be two specific sub-questions to which people want answers, and for which they find answers enlightening. The first can be called the question of the purpose of life. What is the purpose for which human beings were placed on Earth? Why are we here? There are two major classes of answers to this question. Either you believe in a God/spirit/intelligence who had some idea, desire, or intention in creating the world, or you believe in a purely material world in which it and you were not created for any reason. It all just happened as matter and energy interacted according to the laws of nature, which, once life got started, included the principles of Darwinian evolution. Religion is often seen as an answer to the holy question because many religions offer such clear answers to the sub-question of the purpose of life. Science and religion are often seen as antagonists, and indeed they battle over the teaching of evolution in the United States, precisely because they offer conflicting answers. The second sub-question is the question of purpose within life. How ought I to live? What should I do to have a good, happy, fulfilling, and meaningful life? When people ask the holy question, one of the things they are hoping for is a set of principles or goals that can guide their actions and give their choices meaning or value. That is why the form of the answer in the Monty Python movie is correct. Try to be nice to people. Avoid eating fat. Aristotle asked about arete, excellence/virtue, and telos, purpose/goal, and he used the metaphor that people are like archers, who need a clear target at which to aim. Without a target or goal, one is left with the animal default. Just let the elephant graze or roam where he pleases. And because elephants live in herds, one ends up doing what everyone else is doing. Yet the human mind has a rider, and as the rider begins to think more abstractly in adolescence, there may come a time when he looks around, past the edges of the herd, and asks, "Where are we all going? And why?" This is what happened to me my senior year of high school. In my adolescent existentialism, I conflated the two sub-questions. Because I embraced the scientific answer to the question of the purpose of life, I thought it precluded finding purpose within life. It was an easy mistake to make, because many religions teach that the two questions are inseparable. If you believe that God created you as part of His plan, then you can figure out how you ought to live if you are going to play your part properly. The Purpose-Driven Life is a 40-day course that teaches readers how to find purpose within life, from the theological answer, to the question of the purpose of life. The two questions can, however, be separated. The first asks about life from the outside. It looks at people, the earth, and the stars as objects. Why do they all exist? And is properly addressed by theologians, physicists, and biologists. The second question is about life from the inside as a subject. How can I find a sense of meaning and purpose? And is properly addressed by theologians, philosophers, and psychologists. The second question is really empirical, a question of fact that can be examined by scientific means. Why do some people live lives full of zest, commitment, and meaning, but others feel that their lives are empty and pointless? For the rest of this chapter, I will ignore the purpose of life and search for the factors that give rise to a sense of purpose within life. Love and work. When a computer breaks, it doesn't fix itself. You have to open it up and do something to it, or bring it to a specialist for repair. The computer metaphor has so pervaded our thought that we sometimes think about people as computers and about psychotherapy as the repair shop or a kind of reprogramming. But people are not computers, and they usually recover on their own from almost anything that happens to them. I think a better metaphor is that people are like plants. During graduate school, I had a small garden in front of my house in Philadelphia. I was not a very good gardener, and I traveled a lot in the summers, so sometimes my plants withered and nearly died. But the amazing thing I learned about plants is that as long as they are not completely dead, they will spring back to full and glorious life if you just get the conditions right. You can't fix a plant. You can only give it the right conditions, water, sun, and soil, and then wait. It will do the rest. If people are like plants, what are the conditions we need to flourish? In the happiness formula from chapter 5, H, happiness, equals S, set point, plus C, conditions, plus V, voluntary activities. What exactly is C? The biggest part of C, as I said in chapter 6, is love. No man, woman, or child is an island. We are ultra-social creatures, and we can't be happy without having friends and secure attachments to other people. The second most important part of C is having and pursuing the right goals, in order to create states of flow and engagement. In the modern world, people can find goals and flow in many settings, but most people find most of their flow at work. I define work broadly to include anyone's answer to the question, "So, what do you do?" Student and full-time parent are both good answers. Love and work are, for people, obvious analogs to water and sunshine for plants. When Freud was asked what a normal person should be able to do well, he is reputed to have said, "Love and work." If therapy can help a person to do those two things well, it has succeeded. In Maslow's famous hierarchy of needs, once people have satisfied their physical needs, such as food and safety, they move on to needs for love and then esteem, which is earned mostly through one's work. Even before Freud, Leo Tolstoy wrote, "One can live magnificently in this world if one knows how to work and how to love, to work for the person one loves and to love one's work." Having earlier said everything I want to say about love, I will say no more here, but I must say much more about work. When Harry Harlow took his students to the zoo, they were surprised to find that apes and monkeys would solve problems just for the fun of it. Behaviorism had no way to explain such unreinforced behavior. In 1959, the Harvard psychologist Robert White concluded, after surveying research in behaviorism and psychoanalysis, that both theories had missed what Harlow had noticed: the overwhelming evidence that people and many other mammals have a basic drive to make things happen. You can see it in the joy infants take with busy boxes, the activity centers that allow them to convert flailing arm movements into ringing bells and spinning wheels. You can see it in the toys to which older children gravitate. The ones I most intensely longed for as a boy were those that caused movement or action at a distance: remote-controlled cars, guns that shot plastic pellets, and rockets or airplanes of any kind. And you can see it in the lethargy that often overtakes people who stop working, whether from retirement, being fired, or winning a lottery. Psychologists have referred to this basic need as a need for competence, industry, or mastery. White called it the effectance motive, which he defined as the need or drive to develop competence through interacting with and controlling one's environment. Effectance is almost as basic a need as food and water, yet it is not a deficit need, like hunger, that is satisfied and then disappears for a few hours. Rather, White said, effectance is a constant presence in our lives. Dealing with the environment means carrying on a continuing transaction which gradually changes one's relation to the environment. Because there is no consummatory climax, satisfaction has to be seen as lying in a considerable series of transactions, in a trend of behavior rather than a goal that is achieved. The effectance motive helps explain the progress principle. We get more pleasure from making progress toward our goals than we do from achieving them because, as Shakespeare said, joy's soul lies in the doing. Now we can look at the conditions of modern work. Karl Marx's criticism of capitalism was based in part on his justified claim that the Industrial Revolution had destroyed the historical relationship between craftsmen and the goods they produced. Assembly line work turned people into cogs in a giant machine and the machine didn't care about workers' needs for effectance. Later research on job satisfaction supported Marx's critique, but added nuance. In 1964, the sociologists Melvin Kahn and Carmi Schuller surveyed 3,100 American men about their jobs and found that the key to understanding which jobs were satisfying was what they called occupational self-direction. Men who were closely supervised in jobs of low complexity and much routine showed the highest degree of alienation, feeling powerless, dissatisfied, and separated from the work. Men who had more latitude in deciding how they approached work that was varied and challenging tended to enjoy their work much more. When workers had occupational self-direction, their work was often satisfying. Most recent research finds that most people approach their work in one of three ways: as a job, a career, or a calling. If you see your work as a job, you do it only for the money. You look at the clock frequently while dreaming about the weekend ahead, and you probably pursue hobbies, which satisfy your affectance needs more thoroughly than does your work. If you see your work as a career, you have larger goals of advancement, promotion, and prestige. The pursuit of these goals often energizes you, and you sometimes take work home with you because you want to get the job done properly. Yet at times, you wonder why you work so hard. You might occasionally see your work as a rat race, where people are competing for the sake of competing. If you see your work as a calling, however, you find your work intrinsically fulfilling. You are not doing it to achieve something else. You see your work as contributing to the greater good, or as playing a role in some larger enterprise, the worth of which seems obvious to you. You have frequent experiences of flow during the workday, and you neither look forward to quitting time nor feel the desire to shout, "Thank God it's Friday." You would continue to work, perhaps even without pay, if you suddenly became very wealthy. You might think that blue-collar workers have jobs, managers have careers, and the more respected professionals, doctors, scientists, clergy, have callings. Although there is some truth to that expectation, we can nonetheless paraphrase Marcus Aurelius and say, "Work itself is but what you deem it." Amy Wisniewski, a psychologist at New York University, finds all three orientations represented in almost every occupation she has examined. In a study of hospital workers, for example, she found that the janitors who cleaned bedpans and mopped up vomit, perhaps the lowest-ranking job in a hospital, sometimes saw themselves as part of a team whose goal was to heal people. They went beyond the minimum requirements of their job description, for example, by trying to brighten up the rooms of very sick patients or anticipating the needs of the doctors and nurses rather than waiting for orders. In so doing, they increased their own occupational self-direction and created for themselves jobs that satisfied their effectance needs. Those janitors who worked this way saw their work as a calling and enjoyed it far more than those who saw it as a job. The optimistic conclusion coming out of research in positive psychology is that most people can get more satisfaction from their work. The first step is to know your strengths. Take the strengths test and then choose work that allows you to use your strengths every day, thereby giving yourself at least scattered moments of flow. If you are stuck in a job that doesn't match your strengths, recast and reframe your job so that it does. Maybe you'll have to do some extra work for a while, like the hospital janitors who were acting on strengths of kindness, loving, emotional intelligence, or citizenship. If you can engage your strengths, you'll find more gratification in work. If you find gratification, you'll shift into a more positive, approach-oriented mindset, and in such a mindset, it will be easier for you to see the bigger picture, the contribution you are making to a larger enterprise, within which your job might turn into a calling. Work, at its best, then, is about connection, engagement, and commitment. As the poet Khalil Gibran said, "Work is love made visible." Echoing Tolstoy, he gave examples of work done with love. "It is to weave the cloth with threads drawn from your heart, even as if your beloved were to wear that cloth. It is to build a house with affection, even as if your beloved were to dwell in that house. It is to sow seeds with tenderness and reap the harvest with joy, even as if your beloved were to eat the fruit. Love and work are crucial for human happiness because, when done well, they draw us out of ourselves and into connection with people and projects beyond ourselves. Happiness comes from getting these connections right. Happiness comes not just from within, as Buddha and Epictetus supposed, or even from a combination of internal and external factors, as I suggested as a temporary fix at the end of chapter 5. The correct version of the happiness hypothesis, as I'll illustrate next, is that happiness comes from between. Vital engagement. Plants thrive under particular conditions, and biologists can now tell us how sunlight and water get converted into plant growth. People thrive under particular conditions, and psychologists can now tell us how love and work get converted into happiness and a sense of meaning. The man who found flow, Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, thinks big. Not content to study moments of flow by beeping people several times a day, he wanted to know what role flow plays in life as a whole, particularly in the lives of creative people. So he turned to the experts, paragons of success in the arts and sciences. He and his students have interviewed hundreds of successful painters, dancers, poets, novelists, physicists, biologists, and psychologists, all people who seem to have crafted lives for themselves built around a consuming passion. These are admirable lives, desirable lives, the sort that many young people dream of having when they look to these people as role models. Csikszentmihalyi wanted to know how such lives happened. How does a person come to make such a commitment to a field and then become so extraordinarily creative? His interviews showed that every path is unique, yet most of them led in the same direction. From initial interest and enjoyment, with moments of flow, through a relationship to people, practices, and values that deepened over many years, thereby enabling even longer periods of flow. Csikszentmihalyi and his students, particularly Jane Nakamura, have studied the end state of this deepening process and called it vital engagement, which they define as a relationship to the world that is characterized both by experiences of flow, enjoyed absorption, and by meaning, subjective significance. Vital engagement is another way of saying that work has become love made visible. Nakamura and Csikszentmihalyi even describe vital engagement in words that could almost have been taken from a romance novel. There is a strong felt connection between self and object. A writer is swept away by a project. A scientist is mesmerized by the stars. The relationship has subjective meaning. Work is a calling. Vital engagement is a subtle concept, and the first time I taught a course on positive psychology, the students weren't getting it. I thought that an example would help, so I called on a woman who had been quiet in class, but who had once mentioned her interest in horses. I asked Catherine to tell us how she got involved in writing. She described her childhood love of animals, and her interest in horses in particular. At the age of 10, she begged her parents to let her take riding lessons, and they agreed. She rode for fun at first, but soon began riding in competitions. When it came time to choose a college, she chose the University of Virginia in part because it had an excellent riding team. Catherine was shy, and, after narrating these basic facts, she stopped talking. She had told us about her increasing commitment to writing, but vital engagement is more than just commitment. I probed further. I asked whether she could tell us the names of specific horses from previous centuries. She smiled and said, almost as if admitting a secret, that she had begun to read about horses when she began to ride, and that she knew a great deal about the history of horses and about famous horses in history. I asked whether she had made friends through riding, and she told us that most of her close friends were horse friends, people she knew from horse shows and from riding together. As she talked, she grew more animated and confident. It was as clear from her demeanor as from her words that Catherine had found vital engagement in writing. Just as Nakamura and Csikszentmihalyi had said, her initial interest grew into an ever-deepening relationship, an ever-thickening web connecting her to an activity, a tradition, and a community. Writing for Catherine had become a source of flow, joy, identity, affectance, and relatedness. It was part of her answer to the question of purpose within life. Vital engagement does not reside in the person or in the environment. It exists in the relationship between the two. The web of meaning that engulfed Catherine grew and thickened gradually and organically over many years. Vital engagement is what I was missing during my senior year of high school. I had love, and I had work, in the form of reasonably challenging high school classes, but my work was not part of a larger project beyond getting into college. In fact, it was precisely when the college project was ending, when I had sent off my college applications and was in limbo, not knowing where I would go next, that I became paralyzed by the holy question. Getting the right relationship between you and your work is not entirely up to you. Some occupations come ready-made for vital engagement. Others make it difficult. As market forces were reshaping many professions in the United States during the 1990s, medicine, journalism, science, education, and the arts, people in those fields began to complain that the quality of work and the quality of life were sometimes comprised by the relentless drive to increase profits. Csikszentmihalyi teamed up with two other leading psychologists, Howard Gardner at Harvard and William Damon at Stanford, to study these changes and to see why some professions seemed healthy while others were growing sick. Picking the fields of genetics and journalism as case studies, they conducted dozens of interviews with people in each field. Their conclusion is as profound as it is simple. It's a matter of alignment. When doing good, doing high-quality work that produces something of use to others, matches up with doing well, achieving wealth and professional advancement, a field is healthy. Genetics, for example, is a healthy field because all parties involved respect and reward the very best science. Even though pharmaceutical companies and market forces were beginning to inject vast amounts of money into university research labs in the 1990s, the scientists whom Csikszentmihalyi, Gardner, and Damon interviewed did not believe they were being asked to lower their standards, cheat, lie, or sell their souls. Geneticists believed that their field was in a golden age, in which excellent work brought great benefits to the general public, the pharmaceutical companies, the universities, and the scientists themselves. Journalists, on the other hand, were in trouble. Most of them had gone into journalism with high ideals, respect for the truth, a desire to make a difference in the world, and a firm belief that a free press is a crucial support of democracy. But by the 1990s, the decline of family-run newspapers and the rise of corporate media empires had converted American journalism into just another profit center where the only thing that mattered was will it sell, and will it outsell our competitors. Good journalism was sometimes bad for business. Scare stories, exaggeration, trumped-up conflict, and sexual scandal, all cut up into tiny digestible pieces, were often more profitable. Many journalists who worked for these empires confessed to having a sense of being forced to sell out and violate their own moral standards. Their world was unaligned, and they could not become vitally engaged in the larger but ignoble mission of gaining market share at any cost. Cross-level coherence. The word coherence literally means holding or sticking together, but it is usually used to refer to a system, an idea, or a worldview whose parts fit together in a consistent and efficient way. Coherent things work well. A coherent worldview can explain almost anything, while an incoherent worldview is hobbled by internal contradictions. A coherent profession, such as genetics, can get on with the business of genetics, while an incoherent profession, like journalism, spends a lot of time on self-analysis and self-criticism. Most people know there's a problem, but they can't agree on what to do about it. Whenever a system can be analyzed at multiple levels, a special kind of coherence occurs when the levels mesh and mutually interlock. We saw this cross-level coherence in the analysis of personality. if your low-level traits match up with your coping mechanisms, which in turn are consistent with your life story, your personality is well integrated and you can get on with the business of living. When these levels do not cohere, you are likely to be torn by internal contradictions and neurotic conflicts. You might need adversity to knock yourself into alignment. And if you do achieve coherence, the moment when things come together may be one of the most profound of your life. Like the moviegoer, who later finds out what she missed in the first half hour, your life will suddenly make more sense. Finding coherence across levels feels like enlightenment, and it is crucial for answering the question of purpose within life. People are multi-level systems in another way. We are physical objects, bodies and brains, from which minds somehow emerge, and from our minds somehow societies and cultures form. To understand ourselves fully, we must study all three levels: physical, psychological, and sociocultural. There has long been a division of academic labor. Biologists studied the brain as a physical object, psychologists studied the mind, and sociologists and anthropologists studied the socially constructed environments within which minds develop and function. But a division of labor is productive only when the tasks are coherent, when all lines of work eventually combine to make something greater than the sum of its parts. For much of the 20th century, that didn't happen. Each field ignored the others and focused on its own questions. But nowadays, cross-disciplinary work is flourishing, spreading out from the middle level, psychology, along bridges, or perhaps ladders, down to the physical level, for example, the field of cognitive neuroscience, and up to the sociocultural level, for example, cultural psychology. The sciences are linking up, generating cross-level coherence, and like magic, big new ideas are beginning to emerge. Here is one of the most profound ideas to come from the ongoing synthesis. People gain a sense of meaning when their lives cohere across the three levels of their existence. The best way I can illustrate this idea is to take you back to Bhubaneswar, India. I have already explained the logic of purity and pollution, so you understand why Hindus bathe before making an offering to God, and why they are careful about what they touch on the way to the temple. You understand why contact with a dog, a menstruating woman, or a person of low caste can render a person of high caste temporarily impure and unfit to make an offering. But you understand all this only at the psychological level, and even then, only as a set of propositions grasped by the writer and stored away as explicit knowledge. You do not feel polluted after touching the arm of a woman you know to be menstruating. You do not even know what it would feel like to feel polluted in that way. Suppose, however, that you grow up as a Brahmin in Bhubaneswar. Every day of your life, you have to respect the invisible lines separating pure from profane spaces, and you have to keep track of people's fluctuating levels of purity before you can touch them or take anything from their hands. You bathe several times a day, short baths or brief immersions in sacred water, always before making a religious offering. And your offerings are not just words. You actually give some food to God. The priest touches your offering to the image, icon, or object in the inner sanctum, which is returned to you so that you may eat what God left over. Eating someone's leftovers shows a willingness to take in that person's saliva, which demonstrates both intimacy and subordination in Bhubaneswar. Eating God's leftovers is an act of intimacy and subordination too. After 20 years of these practices, your understanding of Hindu rituals is visceral. Your explicit understanding is supported by 100 physical feelings: shivering during the morning bath at sunrise, the pleasure of washing off dust and putting on clean clothes after a bath on a hot afternoon, the feeling of bare feet on cool stone floors as you approach the inner sanctum, the smell of incense, the sound of mumbled prayers in Sanskrit, the bland, pure taste of rice that has been returned to you from God. In all these ways, your understanding at the psychological level has spread down to your physical embodiment, And when the conceptual and visceral levels connect, the rituals feel right to you. Your understanding of ritual spreads up to the socio-cultural level, too. You are immersed in a 4,000-year-old religious tradition that provided most of the stories you heard as a child, many of which involved plot elements of purity and pollution. Hinduism structures your social space through a caste system based on the purity and pollution of various occupations, and it structures your physical space with the topography of purity and pollution that keeps temples, kitchens, and right hands pure. Hinduism also gives you a cosmology in which souls reincarnate by moving up or down on the vertical dimension of divinity. So every time you make an offering to God, the three levels of your existence are all aligned and mutually interlocking. Your physical feelings and conscious thoughts cohere with your actions, and all of it makes perfect sense within the larger culture of which you are a part. As you make an offering to God, you don't think, "What does this all mean? Why am I doing this?" The experience of meaningfulness just happens. It emerges automatically from cross-level coherence. Once again, happiness, or a sense of meaningfulness that imparts richness to experience, comes from between. In contrast, think about the last empty ritual you took part in. Maybe you were asked to join hands and chant with a group of strangers while attending a wedding ceremony for a friend who is of a different religion. Perhaps you took part in a New Age ceremony that borrowed elements from Native Americans, ancient Celts, and Tibetan Buddhists. You probably understood the symbolism of the ritual, understood it consciously and explicitly in the way that the writer is so good at doing, yet you felt self-conscious, maybe even silly, while doing it. Something was missing. You can't just invent a good ritual through reasoning about symbolism. You need a tradition within which the symbols are embedded, and you need to invoke bodily feelings that have some appropriate associations. Then you need a community to endorse and practice it over time. To the extent that a community has many rituals that cohere across the three levels, people in the community are likely to feel themselves connected to the community and its traditions. If the community also offers guidance on how to live and what is of value, then people are unlikely to wonder about the question of purpose within life. Meaning and purpose simply emerge from the coherence, and people can get on with the business of living. But conflict, paralysis, and anomy are likely when a community fails to provide coherence, or worse, when its practices contradict people's gut feelings or their shared mythology and ideology. Martin Luther King Jr. forced Americans to confront contradictions between practices of racial segregation and ideals about equality and freedom. Many people didn't like that. People don't necessarily need to find meaning in their national identity. Indeed, in large and diverse nations such as the United States, Russia, and India, religion might hold greater promise for cross-level coherence and purpose within life. Religions do such a good job of creating coherence, in fact, that some scholars believe they were designed for that purpose. God gives us hives. When I first began to study morality as a philosophy major in college, my father said, "Why aren't you studying religion too? How could people have morality without God?" As a young atheist with a strong sense of morality, well over the border into self-righteousness, I was insulted by my father's suggestion. Morality, I thought, was about relationships among people. It was about a commitment to doing the right thing, even when it goes against your self-interest. Religion, I thought, was a bunch of rules that made no sense and stories that could never have happened, written down by people and then falsely attributed to a supernatural entity. I now believe my father was right. Morality has its origins in religion, but not for the reasons he believed. Morality and religion both occur in some form in all human cultures, and are almost always both intertwined with the values, identity, and daily life of the culture. Anyone who wants a full, cross-level account of human nature, and of how human beings find purpose and meaning in their lives, must make that account cohere with what is known about morality and religion. From an evolutionary perspective, morality is a problem. If evolution is all about survival of the fittest, then why do people help each other so much? Why do they give to charity, risk their lives to save strangers, and volunteer to fight in wars? Darwin thought the answer was easy. Altruism evolves for the good of the group. There can be no doubt that a tribe including many members who, from possessing in a high degree the spirit of patriotism, fidelity, obedience, courage, and sympathy, were always ready to aid one another, and to sacrifice themselves for the common good would be victorious over most other tribes, and this would be natural selection. Darwin proposed that groups compete just like individuals, and therefore psychological features that make groups successful, such as patriotism, courage, and altruism toward fellow group members, should spread like any other trait. But once evolutionary theorists began testing predictions rigorously, using computers to model the interactions of individuals who use various strategies, such as pure selfishness versus tit for tat, they quickly came to appreciate the seriousness of the free rider problem. In groups in which people make sacrifices for the common good, an individual who makes no such sacrifices, who in effect takes a free ride on the backs of the altruists, comes out ahead. In the cold logic of these computer simulations, whoever accumulates the most resources in one generation goes on to produce more children in the next. So selfishness is adaptive, but altruism is not. The only solution to the free rider problem is to make altruism pay, and two back-to-back breakthroughs in evolutionary thinking showed how to do that. In Chapter 3, I presented kin altruism, be nice to those who share your genes, and reciprocal altruism, be nice to those who might reciprocate in the future, as two steps on the way to ultra-sociality. Once these two solutions to the free rider problem were published in 1966 and 1971 respectively, most evolutionary theorists considered the problem of altruism solved and essentially declared group selection illegal. Altruism could be explained away as a special kind of selfishness, and anyone who followed Darwin in thinking that evolution worked for the good of the group instead of the good of the individual, or better yet, the good of the gene, was dismissed as a mushy-headed romantic. The ban on group selection had one loophole. For creatures that really do compete, live, and die as a group, such as the other ultra-social animals, bees, wasps, ants, termites, and naked mole rats, group selection explanations were appropriate. There is a real sense in which a beehive or an ant colony is a single organism, each insect a cell in the larger body. Like stem cells, ants can take different physical forms to perform specific functions needed by the colony. Small bodies to care for larvae, larger bodies with special appendages to forage for food or fight off attackers. Like cells in the immune system, ants will sacrifice themselves to protect the colony. In one species of Malaysian ant, members of the soldier caste store a sticky substance just under their exoskeletons. In the midst of battle, they explode their bodies, turning themselves into suicide bombers to gum up their adversaries. For ants and bees, the queen is not the brain. She is the ovary, and the entire hive or colony can be seen as a body shaped by natural selection to protect the ovary and help it create more hives or colonies. Because all members really are in the same boat, group selection is not just permissible as an explanation, it is mandatory. Might this loophole apply to humans as well? Do humans compete, live, and die as a group? Tribes and ethnic groups do grow and spread or fade and die out, and sometimes this process has occurred by genocide. Furthermore, human societies often have an extraordinary division of labor, so the comparisons to bees and ants is tempting. But as long as each human being has the opportunity to reproduce, the evolutionary payoffs for investing in one's own welfare and one's own offspring will almost always exceed the payoffs for contributing to the group. In the long run, selfish traits will therefore spread at the expense of altruistic traits. Even during war and genocide, when group interests are most compelling, it is the coward who runs and hides, rather than joining his comrades on the front lines, who is most likely to pass on his genes to the next generation. Evolutionary theorists have therefore stood united since the early 1970s in their belief that group selection simply did not play a role in shaping human nature. But wait a second. This is not an all-or-nothing issue. Even if the competition of individuals within a group is the most important process in human evolution, group selection, competition between groups, could have played a role too. The evolutionary biologist David Sloan Wilson has recently argued that the banishment of group selection theories on the basis of some oversimplified computer models from the 1960s was one of the biggest mistakes in the history of modern biology. If you make the models more realistic, more like real human beings, group selection jumps right out at you. Wilson points out that human beings evolve at two levels simultaneously, genetic and cultural. The simple models of the 1960s worked well for creatures without culture. For them, behavioral traits must all be encoded in the genes, which are passed on only along lines of kinship. But everything a person does is influenced not only by her genes, but also by her culture, and cultures evolve too. Because elements of culture show variation, people invent new things, and selection, other people do or don't adopt those variations, cultural traits can be analyzed in a Darwinian framework just as well as physical traits, birds' beaks, giraffes' necks. Cultural elements, however, don't spread by the slow process of having children. They spread rapidly whenever people adopt a new behavior, technology, or belief. Cultural traits can even spread from tribe to tribe or nation to nation, as when the plow, the printing press, or reality television programs became popular in many places in quick succession. Cultural and genetic evolution are intertwined. The human capacity for culture, a strong tendency to learn from each other, to teach each other, and to build upon what we have learned, is itself a genetic innovation that happened in stages over the last few million years. But once our brains reached a critical threshold, perhaps 80,000 to 100,000 years ago, cultural innovation began to accelerate. A strong evolutionary pressure then shaped brains to take further advantage of culture. Individuals who could best learn from others who were more successful than their less cultured brethren, and as brains became more cultural, cultures became more elaborate, further increasing the advantage of having a more cultural brain. All human beings today are the products of the coevolution of a set of genes, which is almost identical across cultures, and a set of cultural elements, which is diverse across cultures, but still constrained by the capacities and predispositions of the human mind. For example, the genetic evolution of the emotion of disgust made it possible, but not inevitable, for cultures to develop caste systems based on occupation and supported by disgust toward those who perform polluting activities. A caste system then restricts marriage to within caste pairings, which in turn alters the course of genetic evolution. After 1,000 years of inbreeding within caste, castes will diverge slightly on a few genetic traits. For example, shades of skin color, which might in turn lead to a growing cultural association of caste with color rather than just with occupation. It only takes 20 generations of selective breeding to create large differences of appearance and behavior in other mammals. In this way, genes and cultures co-evolve. They mutually affect each other, and neither process can be studied in isolation for human beings. Wilson examines religion from this co-evolutionary perspective. The word religion literally means, in Latin, to link or bind together. And despite the vast variation in the world's religions, Wilson shows that religions always serve to coordinate and orient people's behavior toward each other and toward the group as a whole, sometimes for the purpose of competing with other groups. The sociologist Emile Durkheim first developed this view of religion in 1912. A religion is a unified system of beliefs and practices relative to sacred things, that is to say, things set apart and forbidden, beliefs and practices which unite into one single moral community called a church, all those who adhere to them. Wilson shows how religious practices help members solve coordination problems. For example, trust and therefore trade are greatly enhanced when all parties are part of the same religious community, and when religious